Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. We have a fantastic programme lined up for you tonight. In studio, Niall Hatch and Terry Flanagan. At his home in Malahide, Dr. Richard Collins. And at her home in Terenure, and we must say hello to her now to check if she's there, Aina Nilana. And before you answer, Aina, I can just tell you that we had an old school teacher back in the day, and when he was calling the roll, he'd go through everybody's name, and eventually he'd get to me, and he'd say, Mooney, and I'd say, present, and he'd say, Mooney, you may be here physically, but mentally, I'm not at all sure.
I'm physically and mentally present in my home in Terenure, Derek.
Very glad to hear it, Aina, because Niall Hatch, who's sitting in front of me, has a question just for you.
Yes, indeed, Derek. Hello, Aina. Hello, Richard. Aina, I know that you have been involved for several years now with a body called the Campaign for Responsible Rodenticide Use, as has Birdwatch Ireland, all around the responsible use of rat poisons that people would use to control rodents because of the impact that they can have on predators, particularly on birds of prey. Just something came to my attention there just the other day. A good friend of mine who lives not too far away from me in Greystones in North Wicklow, he had seen a strange bird in his garden, and it turned out that it was a female kestrel. It was behaving oddly. He saw it one day, and then the next day he found it dead behind the bins in the garden. And in recent times, I've seen more bait stations around the area, the streets nearby, people put this bait put out for rats and mice, presumably. And I've no way of proving this, but it looks like to me that it's a very strong chance that these two are connected, that this poor unfortunate kestrel, which feeds on rodents, has eaten a contaminated mouse, perhaps, and has succumbed to the poison itself. I believe that this is quite a problem around Ireland. As we drive around, and Derek, you and I have spoken about this before, driving, for example, between Dublin and Cork, as we do every year for the Dawn Chorus programme, I see fewer and fewer kestrels along the side of the road. You used to see on that drive, you maybe see a dozen hovering there at the side of the road. Now, if I see one, it's kind of a landmark occasion. It's something that I would note.
Yeah, I don't see them at all, hardly.
Yeah, they're very, very scarce. So, just something, Aina, that struck me. In terms of the campaign for responsible rodenticide use, what would be the main tips there for people, and how is the campaign itself going?
Well, no, this is a very interesting one. In fact, I see buzzards and no kestrels when I'm out and about. But I wonder who's putting down these bait boxes. Is it local authorities? Is it the local house owners? Is it shop owners? I mean, do you know, are they sort of all with the same logo on them indicating they're local authorities? Have you any idea about that, first of all?
I don't. I haven't seen logos on them at all. And I see them it's not just confined to Greystones. I'm seeing more of these everywhere where I happen to go around Ireland.
You can't miss them. They're green, usually green.
Yes, that's right.
And they've got a hole at one end and you see them tucked up alongside a building. I see lots of them. Anywhere there's new construction, you see these things.
Exactly. And that may be tied to the fact that they're around Greystones, there is quite a lot of new construction happening. So maybe that is the case. As sites are cleared, it does lead to rodents leaving those sites and flooding into gardens and so on, which obviously nobody wants to see happening. But the irony of it is that the best rodenticides of all are these birds of prey, like the kestrels, like the buzzards, like the barn owls and the long-eared owls around the area. And the more of those that are killed with rodenticide inadvertently, and nobody's doing this deliberately, but inadvertently these birds are dying, the more rodents there'll be, therefore the more need there will be for more rat poison.
Well, now, come on now, the birds of prey can't get in to your house to eliminate the rodents if they're in there. And you know how quickly rodents reproduce.
Oh, absolutely, but these aren't in houses. So, absolutely.
They're not in houses, but they're coming and going around the houses, around the perimeters. They're sniffing out food wherever they can get it and trying to get in to get even more or get in for the heat, whatever the case may be.
Oh, absolutely.
There aren't enough birds of prey.
And we're the ones responsible for that. We need to do more to redress this natural balance. And the poison is playing a role there, of course. But the thing is, it's not the campaign for ending rodenticide use. It's the campaign for responsible rodenticide use. There are ways in which that this bait and these poisons can be used in a way that minimises the impact on other birds. Isn't that right, Aina?
Yes, Niall, I'm glad you brought this up. And there's actually a been a complete overhaul of the rules about using rat poisons in Europe, because the whole situation over the last 20 years has changed enormously. Rat poisons originally were what we called first generation anticoagulants, things like warfarin. So if rats and mice ate this, they would bleed to death, particularly mice. But what happened, of course, was that they quickly became immune to this, and they had to go on to have second generation anticoagulants. And there are five of these, and they are exceedingly toxic and poisonous. And now we're discovering, and certainly in Britain, and there's been pockets of it discovered in Ireland as well, that the rats in particular are becoming immune to some of these as well. So the EU have tightened up enormously on the regulations, and this whole idea of willy-nilly putting out rat poison has been banned. To put out the really strong second generation anticoagulants, you have to be a professional rodent pest control person, someone like the likes of Rentokil or someone like that. And they can buy this very strong rat poisons in special places where they have to produce documentation to say they have been trained for this. Farmers with a herd number can buy it for their own use, and ordinary punters like you and me can only buy very small amounts with much reduced amount of toxins in it. And that's the way they're to be sold. If they're sold any other way, the people selling them are breaking the law. That's the first thing. Now, the second thing is that if there is, let us say, building construction or some carry on going on that there's rodents to be seen and pest control people have been called in, the first thing they do is they put out the bait boxes everywhere, because rats are neophytes. And this means that they are very suspicious of anything new. So therefore, they put in these bait boxes all around the place with no poisonous bait in them. They might put in the actual things, the wax blocks, but there's no, these are dummies, if you like, to get the rats used to them being there. And then, and only then, when the rats are accustomed to all of this, will they put it out. There's a strict quota. They can only be used for 30 days. If the rats are not cleared by then, they cannot put out permanent bait. This is against the law, and if this is discovered, there's prosecutions to be had. And the problem of the reason for this is that we will end up with our rats being immune to the poisons we have, and then we'll really be in trouble. So this is all very strictly controlled. Now, obviously, there are people who don't obey the controls and things like this, but the Campaign for Responsible Rodenticide Use has been very effective in pushing for these rules to be applied, and the Department of Agriculture are the ones with the inspectors. So what they normally say is that one should have an integrated approach to this. What do rodents want? They want food and water, they want shelter, they want harbourage. And if you don't have loads of rubbish around the place, bags of food put out after hours from food takeaways, if you don't have harbourage, rubbish and pallets and stuff that they can go in and hide in, then you're taking away their comforts. So all of these things are to be tried first. Poisons are always said by the Campaign for Responsible Rodenticide Use that they are the very last straw. They're not the first thing you go to. It's the last thing you go to. So if there has been this carry on going on in Greystones recently, there may be some, you know, something going on. But if they're there for longer than 30 days with active poisons in them, they're against the law. So, I mean, that's what we have. So who's going to enforce the law, I suppose, is the next thing.
That's very useful information, Aina, and I hope you know, a lot of people are making note of it, because I think that it's something that is not widely known in Ireland. It should be known much better, I think. Do you know, is there any requirement on the people who put out the bait boxes to put some sort of date on them saying when they've been laid down?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, there's paperwork associated with the companies. So if you get in an official pest control company, the first thing to do is a survey of the area to see, and they, are there rats there? Where are they coming from? Are there tracks and trails? Is there loads of rubbish and mess? No point in putting out poisons if the mess and rubbish and food is still there. That's not what you do. So they have to make notes of all this, site maps. They have to draw places where they put the bait boxes, say what bait goes into them, how much is used, are there droppings, is there evidence of this? And of course, the big thing is that we don't get non-target species. The only species that are targeted are mice and rats. And in general now, to be fair, the mice and the rats, when they don't feel well, go off into their burrows to die. It's quick acting enough, but it's not instantaneous, so that they don't really, a lot of them are not staggered and around half dead because they've gone back to from whence they came to die out of sight, because we are doing this survey on, what would you call it, on resistance, and asking these men to send us in bits of rats that they have found. And they find it very hard to find the rats to cut off their tails to send them in to actually test for the fact that things might be immune to this, although we have enough for this PhD student who's working on it down in Waterford to be able to say there are pockets of resistance to rat poisons in Ireland. So that's a really worrying thing, and the EU are on top of it, and these regulations come in from Europe. So interesting to see how it'll go in Greystones. I mean, that dead bird, I mean, that's how we know as well. There's a raptor protocol where people who find dead birds of prey send them into the National Parks and Wildlife Service, who are able to send them off to the vet for veterinary analysis to see what different things they have in them. John Losby started this about 10, 15 years ago. And at that time, in 2013, he discovered that 80% of our barn owls had rodenticides in them. Now, not enough to kill them, but certainly not doing them any good, and probably affecting their reproduction rates and things like this. 80%, and nobody puts out poisons to kill barn owls. So this was why this was all brought into Ireland 10 years ago in the first instance, because of the impact it was having on our birds of prey and indeed on our top mammal predators as well, things like stoats and foxes and things like that, that were accumulating poisons if they were exposed to this sort of thing.
I saw a dead fox on the way in today, and actually what crossed my mind was, who's going to pick it up? What happens to it? How did it die? It didn't look like it was hit by a car. Did it die of secondary poisoning? And remember, foxes and birds of prey are taking very healthy rodents. You know, they don't have to be sick to be caught by a fox or a rat. They may be feeling ill, and on the way back to the burrow, they can still be hit off whether they're ill or not. Terry, you want to say something?
No, I was just going to say, we were talking there earlier on about the decrease in the kestrel numbers and the increase in the buzzard numbers. I'm just wondering, is there a correlation between them? Are they competing for the same foods? Or maybe, has any study been done on the effects of these rodenticides on kestrel and on buzzards? Maybe the rodenticide is having a different effect on the buzzard than it is on the kestrel.
I think that within Ireland, the diet of the kestrel is more limited than that of the buzzard. They very much specialise in feeding on rodents. And because we have little by way of other types of rodents other than rats and mice, we do have the introduced bank vole. We do have a couple of non-rodents, two species of shrew, one native, one non-native, that kestrels will eat as well. And they do also eat lizards. I've seen them do that when you see the lizards sometimes basking on rocks or on train tracks on sunny days. But the vast majority of their diet would be made up of rats and mice here in Ireland, whereas in Britain and on the continent, they have a much wider diet. They will eat lots of rats and mice, but they also eat voles, which tend not to be coming in contact very much with rat poison. They eat things like lemmings or hamsters, creatures like that that we don't have here in Ireland. Buzzards have a much wider diet, so they will eat rats and mice, but they will also eat things like young crows. They love to hunt rabbits, something that a kestrel couldn't do. A rabbit's far too big for a kestrel. And buzzards are also more likely to scavenge roadkill and dead animals. So buzzards may well go for that fox that you saw there, Derek, mm-hmm. as will the crows, which is something that the kestrels don't really do very much. We know that in other countries around Europe, including just across the water in Britain, both kestrels and buzzards have coexisted for many, many generations, for centuries, even millennia, and both are very common. So I don't think that the number of buzzards in Ireland is having any effect or negative effect on the number of kestrels. In fact, it may even be benefiting kestrels because they tend to reduce the crow populations. Ireland has a very high density of crow species, much more so than other European countries. And that's been because of the absence of these large birds of prey.
Well, anecdotally, I can tell you that I drive up and down to Cork quite a lot to work for the Today programme on RTE Cork. And where I used to see kestrels, they're not replaced by buzzards.
No.
Along that stretch of motorway. So I couldn't say that the buzzards have replaced them, because I don't see the buzzards.
Yes.
Not saying I don't see them at all, but I don't see them as frequently as I saw kestrels.
But their numbers are definitely increasing around the country.
Oh, very much so. And it's a bird that has made a big resurgence, a big comeback in recent years here in Ireland, which is really good to see. I often see them around the M50 now, perched on the lampposts. They do quite well in human-altered landscapes, more so than many other birds of prey. But these are abundant species living in tandem across Europe, and they don't really seem to affect each other.
Richard.
This is a fascinating fascinating subject, a very depressing subject in a way. It seems that poisons have had their day, for the moment anyway, until a one that specifically targets rodents can be developed. In the meantime, therefore, we must fall back on traditional methods. We must block up all holes entering buildings so the rodents can't get in, a tall order, I must say. And we must gather up all our rubbish and keep it under wraps because rats love rubbish. Now, the other thing, an offence of my own, is to leave out pet food for the cat at night, which is not a good idea. Or the bird table. The bird table is going to be there. The birds eat some of the stuff, but not all of it, so the rats are going to come along. So these are the... And I remember long ago in Europe seeing farms with barn owl boxes already fitted, and they claimed that they had barn owls and they nurture the barn owls so that it would keep the farm free of rodents. Now, of course, if the rodents are already carrying poison, that doesn't work. But if we could get the poison levels down, would that work? Is this the best blueprint we can come up with, Eanna, for keeping rodents down?
Yes, Richard, the barn owl box scheme is here in Ireland as well. The latest scheme for farmers now is called Acres, and there are different schemes or different bits of the Acres project which are for environmental matters, planting hedgerows, that sort of thing. But the barn owl boxes are one of them, and farmers are given the barn owl boxes to erect them, and if barn owls take up residence, they get lots of money. They get some money to put them up. If they're successful, they get more money. And the farmers themselves are actually very interested in this. And there are some of them have been occupied that weren't ever there, you know, in that area before. And barn owls in a breeding season can eat 50 rats, up to 50 rats, say 500 a week or something of that order. It's an enormous amount that they can catch. But the putting out of the poison willy-nilly is inspected on farms. The bait boxes may be there, but if there's bait in them on a continuous basis, they have to justify their existence with the paperwork, and they won't get their farm payments if they're disobeying these laws. So, I mean, the situation, and a lot of farmers don't particularly want to be putting out poisons as well too, because, I mean, they hadn't gotten to the stage, Niall, where a permanent bait box could actually be infiltrated by things like slugs and snails, then eaten by small birds, which were eaten by things like peregrine falcons and sparrowhawks, who were also having poisons detected in them, and they never went near a rat at all. So, I mean, this was really ringing the alarm bells for the EU and the legislation. So they're death down. And I mean, permanent bait in boxes is a huge no-no. We shouldn't be able, without herd numbers and special education, to be an official rat catcher. Ordinary people shouldn't be able to buy these very strong rat poisons in the first instance, only very small amounts of actual less intense ones. So this is all been done at official level, so the knowledge is there that this is there, and we must actually behave in a responsible fashion, or we will have nothing to kill the rats with. And the traps that Richard is speaking about, they're all governed as well, so they're not cruel any longer. Break back traps, catching a rat by the tail or something. They actually have rat traps now, Richard, that are connected to your mobile phone. You put out 20 of them, and if anything gets caught in it, you get a message on your phone and you run out to trap number 6 and there's something in it, whatever it is, and you're able to either dispatch it or release it or whatever. So they're moving with the times with the rat traps as well, which of course is great to see.
So there is hope, Anna. There is hope that we can address this problem effectively.
I'm certainly glad I asked the question, and I hope that that poor kestrel's death wasn't in vain. Hopefully some of our listeners have become more aware of this topic now. And just to say, if anyone wants more information about the campaign for responsible rodenticide use and details on how that you can use these poisons as safely as possible, and there's always a risk, but as safely as possible, you can go to crru.ie.
And we'll make sure those details are on the website. Anyway, let's move on with a positive story. Terry Flanagan, Harvest Men.
Harvest Men, yes, we're talking about poor old kestrel there in trouble. Well, here's a nice story. A new species of harvestmen was recently discovered here in Ireland. Brian Murray, who's the founder member of MicroWild, that's a native wildlife meadow and invertebrate reserve in County Wicklow. He's a citizen scientist and he spends his time out looking for interesting invertebrates. And he has found a new species of harvestman here in Ireland. Now, it's not new to science. It was first discovered in 2004 in the Netherlands. But since then, it's been found in Poland, in Germany, various places like that. But this is the first time it's been found in Ireland. Now, it's called a harvestman because they mature around this time of the year, around the autumn time when the harvest is present. So I met him recently on the Curragh of County Kildare.
OK, so we're here, Terry. We're going to do this now.
OK, we've arrived here. We're down in the Curragh in County Kildare. And it's not just the two of us because we've also got a very special, I'm not going to say person, but a very special animal with us as well. Tell us a little bit about it.
We do indeed. So what we have here in this box, and we're just about to release it, is a specimen of a harvestman called Liobunum species A.
Harvestmen, they're sometimes called daddy long legs, but I don't think that's correct, is it?
No. I mean, there's actually three species of animal that are called daddy long legs, which makes this whole thing really, really confusing. We have the cellar spiders. Those are the guys that sit up on the corner of your roof in or the ceiling inside your house. And then we have the crane flies that we mostly see in the autumn. Those are the guys that fly with the big gangly legs that kind of come straight for your face by accident. And then we have the daddy long legs we're talking about here, which are harvestmen, and they're opilions.
Right. Now, I'm looking at him here because you have him in a container. He's very different to any of the ones I've seen before because of his legs. The legs are huge.
He's definitely the biggest we have in this country now by a long shot. And I'm looking at his legs here and I can see these ones are probably about 7.5 to 8 inches in diameter.
And the body is tiny, absolutely tiny.
It is, yeah. And that is characteristic of a lot of harvestmen. You have this tiny little body and then you have these big legs that allow them to escape fast, or, you know, they travel through the grass or through the undergrowth or even the overgrowth. We see a lot of them in the leaves of the trees above us.
They're arachnids. They look like spiders, but they're not spiders.
Definitely not spiders, so nobody has to fear them. What we have with the harvestmen is what makes them different from spiders is that they don't have fangs, they don't produce venom, and they don't produce silk, so they don't make any type of webs. And actually, if you see them up close, really up close, and you look just below their eyes, you see they actually have two little kind of claws, like a crab's claws, that they actually pick away at their food with and actually put it into their mouth. Mm. So they don't attack in the sense and venomate and all that kind of stuff. They just capture on the go, and they eat a lot of kind of they're omnivorous, and they'll eat a lot of kind of dead things, fungus, plant material, and, you know, any dead insects they find. And live prey, you're probably looking at springtails would be the biggest thing they'd catch, but springtails are tiny.
And they certainly wouldn't bite humans.
They can't bite humans because they just don't have that facility to do it.
The distinguishing feature, as I'm looking at this particular one here, are the 8 legs. And what I do notice is that the second pair of legs are longer than all of the others.
And that's true of most, if not all, harvestmen, actually. So those second pair of legs have sensory function to them. So they can effectively figure out their environment using those legs. If you see a harvestman wandering around on its own, those second set of legs are constantly going up and down, side to side, and they're feeling the temperature, they're tasting, they know exactly what the constituents is that they're walking across, because everything comes in through those legs. The eyesight itself isn't great.
Now, your specimen here definitely has 8 legs, but I have seen them occasionally missing a leg.
They do. They actually lose legs very easily, and that's, I suppose, a form of defence. And one thing that happens often when they lose the leg is that leg will continue to move for a period of time after they lose the leg. So if you go to grab a harvestman by a single leg, you might most likely be left with just that leg and the harvestman will run away. So it's a form of defence for them to escape.
But they don't regrow these legs?
They don't, no. Unfortunately, unlike some other invertebrates, they don't regrow the legs. And if it's the second set of legs, those sensory set of legs that they lose, that becomes problematic, because then they can't really sense out the environment and they don't know where they are and what they're interacting with.
Looking at this little guy here, he's very active, but he's a very special harvestman. Explain why.
He is. He's not little, though. He's a very special harvestman. He's the first of his kind to be properly recorded in Ireland, and his name is Liobunum species A. So it's the first time that we've recorded this species in this country, and we have a population of them here, actually, that we're going to release this guy back into.
Now, you discovered him. How did you discover him?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. Back in December of 2023, a member of the Facebook group Insects and Invertebrates of Ireland posted a photo of something that he saw on one of the walls around us here, and was looking for an identification. And there was no real... The photograph was a little bit kind of out of focus, a little bit iffy. We couldn't make a real determination on it, but I had been studying harvestman for probably about 6 months at this stage, and I knew by looking at it that there was something special about it. So I wanted to go and actually see it myself. Unfortunately, where it is part of the army camp, so you can't get access to it. So it took a long time to actually gain access to the army camp itself so I could make a determination. When I arrived, it was in June of 2024, and all of the harvestmen that were around were juveniles. Now, unfortunately for me, juveniles of the native species and juveniles of this species look exactly the same up to a period of time. These harvestmen go through about 7 or 8 molts before they become adults. So I had to take a few specimens with me and rear them, feed them and water them for a few months so I could actually determine at the end that it was this species. And I was lucky enough to know the guy who actually found this species originally in the Netherlands in 2004, and I sent him some photos and he confirmed for me that it was this species, Liobunum species A.
So this particular species was first discovered in 2004 in the Netherlands. It's never been discovered here in Ireland until you found it.
Until that photograph set me on that path to actually go and find out what it was that I saw. And this species actually is an interesting one because it's called species A, which is, you know, obviously if you're in the know, you know that that's an unusual name for an animal. But the reasoning behind that is that it turned up in the Netherlands in 2004, but nobody knew where it came from. So nobody knew if it had been described for science before, so they couldn't give it a name at that time. Now, recently I was talking to Hay Weinhoven, who discovered the animal, and he told me that they've now actually found out where it's from, and now they can go about the process of actually giving it a proper name.
You're not a professional entomologist. It's really just a hobby for you. And for somebody like you, to find something like this is incredible. And you haven't done it once, you've actually done it twice. This is the second species that you've found here in Ireland.
It is indeed. A number of years back, I discovered the first instance of a particular wasp, a potter wasp, that's found in Europe. I found it not far from here in Blessington, where I live. I was out walking one evening and I saw a specific wasp on a particular ragwort plant, and I kind of thought it looked a little bit strange. So I captured it and I had to send it off to the UK to get it identified. And it turned out it was a species called Euodinaris dantici, and it was the first instance of that wasp ever in Ireland. So that specimen actually currently sits in the Natural History Museum.
So you're what's referred to as a citizen scientist. Explain what a citizen scientist is and the importance of them.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are citizen scientists and they don't even know it. If you're interacting with nature every day and you're looking at what's around you, and if you go that little step further to actually look into what it is you're seeing and perhaps even reporting it to the National Biodiversity Data Centre, you are a citizen scientist. So, you know, it's Joe Bloggs off the street, taking an interest in nature, whether it be animals or plants, and taking that a little bit further to the point where they're actually feeding that information back into the National Biodiversity Data Centre, and so scientists in the future can actually have a look at this and determine what was where and when. All of these things turn us into citizen scientists.
What is the importance then of citizen scientists to the progression of science in general?
So most scientists related to entomology, I would say these days, are involved in universities and doing very detailed and complex studies, whether it's to do with how pesticides affect bees or how, you know, or doing genomic studies on the insects and invertebrates. All of those things take an awful long time and they're very, very detailed and complex. Most of those guys are not out in the field much. They're in the lab and they're doing all these studies. And it really falls to us who go out every day, take our dog for a walk, you know, like to take a hike up the mountains, to actually have a look around us and see, you know, does this thing belong in this landscape? Does this thing belong in Ireland? And it doesn't take much to figure out whether that is true or not. And you have the Facebook group like Insects and Vertebrates of Ireland. You have myself and a load of guys on Twitter. And, you know, there's lots of people that you can interact with who can actually help in that way. But one of the things I will say is that the origins of all of these things, this citizen science, really, if you look back in the 1800s, late 1700s and early 1800s, you had people who were like vicars who, you know, they were doing a sermon once a week or twice a week, but they had all this free time in between. Those were the guys that were going out and finding things. And, you know, this was their hobby. They were pinning insect collections and they were finding, you know, what was around their area at that given time. And those collections exist today and they inform us a lot about the insect and vertebrate animal life in Ireland and in the UK and elsewhere at that time. We're just doing the same. We're a bit more digital. I guess one thing I would like to say is harvestmen are a very accessible and easily accessible order of insects or invertebrates to study. I would like to encourage everyone to go out, turn a rock, turn a log, look at a wall, look at the window ledges, check and see what you can see in terms of harvestmen. Take photographs, take lots of photographs up close if you can, and get yourself on the internet. There are lots and lots of guides that will show you what it is you're looking at. But I think it's time for the harvestman to come out into the light.
And you can see some wonderful photographs of harvest men on our website, rte.ie/Moody. Time for a musical interlude, I think.
Stop, whoa, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
Wait,
Mr. Postman.
The Carpenters with Mr. Postman, a hit for them in 1975. What's it got to do with nature? Well, I'm about to tell you. So, do you have any relatives in the States? Do you live in the States? Are you listening there now? Did you ever order anything that came from the States? Did it have a stamp on it when it arrived or when you sent it? Was it handled by the United States Postal Service? So, if you go onto their website, the US Postal Service, Postal Facts will tell you that in 2023, 13.68 billion US postage stamps were printed and $3.96 billion in stamps and stamp product orders were received by mail. They go on. Postage stamps are miniature works of art, indeed they are, designed to reflect the American experience. Stamps highlight heroes, history, milestones, achievements, and natural wonders. There's a story behind every stamp. And indeed, there is. This story has to do with the image of a leatherback turtle, which was taken by one of our contributors, marine scientist Rowan Byrne, originally from Howth, now living in the UK. Rowan has travelled extensively in an effort to conserve wildlife and has done a lot of work on marine turtles. And it was one of his pictures that was chosen for a set of stamps celebrating sea turtles and highlighting their endangered status. Rowan joins us now from his home in Cambridge. Rowan, first of all, congratulations. How on earth, of all the people and all the places in all the world, did you manage to have a stamp chosen by the US Postal Service?
Well, a couple of years ago now, I was contacted by colleagues through the US Postal Service saying they were putting together a new set of stamps to educate the diversity and beauty of endangered sea turtles. And if you had any photographs, and I have a few of them over the years, and I had one particular one of an endangered leatherback sea turtle hatchling running down the beaches of Dominica. And it's very crystal clear. It's fantastic. And you see everything about the turtles. And they said, could we use it? I said, no question at all, folks. And it's been immortalised now with another set, another five, a set of six, illustrating the sea turtles in the US coastal waters and their endangered status and highlighted them. And it's I still can't get over it, Derek. I mean, out of all the millions of photographs, that tens of millions that could have been chosen, that they found one by this Irish fellow over here who did a little bit of work around the world on sea turtles.
As you heard me say at the beginning there, Rowan, 13.68 billion stamps produced every year, equating to almost $4 billion worth of business. They must have paid you a fortune for that image.
I wish. No, there was very little involved. Derek, I would have done it for free. I've been a servant to sea turtles for many of my life, and I took all these photographs and I've been using them in all the materials and publications and papers. So, as I said, I was delighted to provide it free of charge, even just to be asked, Derek, to be honest.
Absolutely. Now, you spent a great deal of your working life in the early years anyway. That's how I met you first, working with sea turtles. So what is the plight of the leatherback turtle, and do we have them in Irish waters?
Yes, we do. Well, the plight of the leatherback sea turtles is as ever endangered, but they, in some elements, in some areas of the world, they are in the increase, especially with all the substantial projects that are going on in the Caribbean that I've been involved with and other peoples are leading on. They are in decline in the Pacific because you have two sort of subpopulations of the same species. You have the Atlantic leatherback and you have the Pacific leatherback. And of course, the larger the area, the more unregulated some of the fisheries are and the higher the bycatches. But yes, we have them in Irish waters. Closer to home, as in just across the water in Wales, I think it was in 1988, the largest leatherback ever caught to date, a male, was 916 kgs, about over 2,000 pounds, over a tonne in weight, was caught off Claroch, off the Welsh coast. It was still within the English Channel and the Irish Sea, and it's ended up in the National History Museum in Cardiff. And anybody who ever wanted to see the fantastic individuals that they are and the size and the majesty of these creatures, you can go to the Cardiff Natural History Museum. But they regularly visit the Irish coast. They're elusive. They obviously come up for this area of the world for a small gelatinous marine organisms, siphonophores, but mostly jellyfish. So it's pretty sure that when any of your listeners are walking around the beaches of Howth or Killiney or the west or east coast or wherever, Donegal, and there's jellyfish about, you can be pretty sure that there's leatherbacks knocking about. But they're quite elusive and they like deep water, and they only ever come to the surface for a breath of fresh air, for want of a better expression. And it's hard to see unless you're at sea, but you can see them from cliff tops as well as like marine mammals and things like that as well. But they are there and it's part of their migratory route.
Rowan, it's Niall here. Congratulations on this amazing achievement. I'm really chuffed to know that so many people around the US and internationally are going to see your photograph on their mail.
Thinking, Niall, you must have sent lots of mail from the States because you studied out there.
I did. I was based in Cornell University for a while, and I did. I wrote a lot of letters home and sending people books and so on, and I wish I could have had a lovely turtle stamp to fly the flag for conservation.
One of your old mates to send you one.
I actually will do that.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
but the leatherback particularly, that of all the sea turtles, and I've been lucky to see a few over the years. The leatherback's probably my favourite. It's the biggest in the world, first of all, but it's also the one that looks like the ultimate swimming machine. They are the most streamlined and hydrodynamic of the sea turtles, and they're different from the others in that they're aptly named. Rather than having a hard shell, as most people think a turtle would, they have a leathery, ridged sort of shell with almost these go-faster stripes on it to help them to swim, these big front paddles and when on the flippers. And then the thing with them, of course, as well, is that like all of these sea turtles, they're incredibly docile as well. There's something very endearing about them as a group, these gentle giants of the sea. It's sad to think how endangered many species have become around the world, and it's great to hear about these conservation initiatives. And now, of course, Rowan, more and more people will be learning about this through your photograph.
Will it make any difference, you think, Rowan?
Without question, Derek, and you've all just educated myself with the amount of people who use the stamp. So even if you get 10% of that learning about sea turtles, that's amazing. That's a great step in the right direction. And as Niall pointed out, they're gentle giants and they are so endearing. I mean, I've been on so many beaches with these animals, and when they first came up, I was like, I won't swear on the radio, but I was like, look at the size of that thing. It's like a dinosaur. It's colossal. And when they crawl out of the water and you see them and you see the length of the flippers, I mean, just to give you an idea, I mean, as far as you both can reach your arms from left to right, you extend your arms out, that's the width of a leatherback sea turtle, and the average length would be anything from 6 to 8 feet long from the tip of their nose, their snout, to the tip of their carapace at the back of their tail. I mean, that's just, it's a colossal animal, and he's half a ton in weight. They are, as Niall said, they are absolutely majestic creatures, and I implore implore anyone who ever gets a chance to see these critters on the beach, which is the most important time in their life cycle, go and see them. And I was blessed in Dominica to be part of a project still ongoing. And, you know, in certain circumstances, it's not all like this, but you could be sitting there having your dinner and then go out and get hear a bell and you go out and see a leatherback sea turtle that existed in prehistoric times, you know, and had family there. But colossal animals, and all these projects that are going on are making a massive difference. And of course, these stamps, well, I hope a lot of fishermen use the stamps as well, because then they can help educate it too. But more tools are always very helpful.
Rowan, congratulations. Terry here. Tell me a little bit about the difficulties of underwater photography. Do you need a whole different set of cameras and lenses and that to get some wonderful shots underwater as well as the ones that you can get on land?
You do, Terry. Not only before you get to the camera equipment, you need to be a good diver. You need to know how to be negatively and positively buoyant. In other words, just be able to stay still in the water. And the one thing I learned very early on in my career on underwater photography is controlling the bubbles. So when you exhale your CO2, you don't want it coming into the photograph still. Because they have the camera to your mask and you're taking a picture of the subject and your regulator is just below you. And I remember years ago, I took many photographs. That's going to be amazing. What's all that stuff? Oh, it's bubbles. Oh my God. I exhaled exactly at the moment I pressed the shutter. So before you even get to photography, it's about being able to control your breathing and control your balance. And then when you've got that sorted, making sure you don't scare the subject, even if it's a small seahorse or a small frogfish. And also you don't touch the reef or you don't, you know, put your hand down to balance yourself. But the technology behind it is moving really faster. It's going into nanotechnology now. But I use a Olympus underwater systems with strobes, flash strobes either side. And then when you angle the strobes, it's very important as well to make sure that you don't completely blow up the subject. In other words, you just colour it with a very strong flash, or you angle the flash to give it the background scatter. And then more importantly, if you're not stable in the water and you're touching the reef or you're near the seabed or near the sediment and you've disturbed the sand, when you take a picture, the flash will light up all the backscatter and the sediment in the water. So it's there's a lot of things to do before you get there. And then more importantly, and this is a sad lesson I learned very quickly on in my underwater career, was make sure your O-ring, which is a small piece of rubber that goes around the inside of the camera at the back and the lens, has just a normal bit of grease on it, O-ring grease. And you know what the irony is? Underwater photography has all the technology. It has all the technical stuff you can get with the equipment and the software and the hardware. But if you have a teeny weeny speck of grit, just a little bit of grit, anywhere on the aperture or the back of the camera where it's attached to the, where you've just put the grease on, it'll flood. And then that's the end of your camera. So even all this technology that's on board and even all the new nano sizes of cameras, if you don't take care, it's almost like the oil in an engine. If you don't take care of it, then you're going to have a very expensive bill when you come up off that dive.
Richard.
Yes, the original armoured personnel carriers. They're cute. They were cute oars, the turtles, because back in the age of the dinosaurs, they opted for a rather curious strategy. That is, carry your house around with you on your back. And they're a very low metabolism. They can go for ages without food. So if things go wrong, you retreat into your house and you lock the door. And in the case of the great big leatherback, it's a tractor tire you have on top of you, effectively. And it is a very good strategy. And, of course, how wise they were. Because 66 million years ago, the dinosaurs are wiped out, leaving the sea and every place else wide open to them, and they thrived as a result in all probability. Now, the leatherbacks we have here, do they come from the Caribbean or from South America? I believe there's a population breeding in the Gabon. Have we made any progress here? Because this is a true Irish species. It's a great privilege in Ireland that we have the second largest reptile in the world swimming around our shores, just as we have the second largest fish in the world, the Basking shark, swimming around our shores. So our ones, do they come from the Gabon or do they cross from the Atlantic, from the Caribbean?
Well, it's intuitive that you asked me that, because in 2008 I did an exact study like that. I put satellite transmitters, what they call satellite delay relay loggers, SRDLs, on leatherbacks to do exactly that, to understand where these animals are coming from and what they're doing. And obviously I was doing on nesting females, so when they came up onto the beach I was able to deploy the transmitter on them. And I had two transmitters deployed and found from that the females that are nested in Dominique and the Caribbean, they did travel up to Ireland. After they'd finished nesting towards the end of the season, because we were able to map their distribution around the Caribbean, they did travel up to Ireland. And of course, it correlates with their migration and their need for sustenance and food at different times of the year. Obviously, they've been depleted after they've nested a number of times for a number of months in the Caribbean. And then they would come up on the jellyfish stocks that were up here in the North Atlantic and beyond. And what you'll find is that leatherbacks that leave the Caribbean and actually will do post-nesting, after they've left nesting, do go to West Africa. You're absolutely right. And even they even go up to the Canadian waters and feed on up there as well. So they go across the North Atlantic Ridge. They work their way across to Western Africa. They do go up to the Bay of Biscay in France. And they work their way up actually into the English Channel, found off Wales, as I said, and then off the coast, and even as far as Donegal and further north. Because one of the things that they can do, which is just utterly amazing, they have a countercurrent heat exchange system, which basically means they can regulate their body temperature depending on the coldness or the depth of the water. In other words, they'll keep their inner core warmer than their exterior and their internal organs, and they recirculate the heat around them, and given the environment that they're in. But you're right, these are leviathans of the deep that travel tens and thousands of kilometres around the world, and especially from the Caribbean to Ireland to Canada to Africa and even to South Africa and more. And this is why we need to understand more about where they go and what they do, because this is a shared problem in order to reduce bycatch. And if they're crossed, they don't know geographical boundaries or who's in charge of what water space. And this is why we all need to work together. So, it's more studies that involve the tracking of sea turtles. And I think if you go to seaturtle.org, there's a huge resource on that website that shows you countless numbers of studies across the world tracking all different species of sea turtles. And I would encourage some of your younger listeners to definitely go on board and even adopt one or two of the turtles and see where they're going every day and get updates.
It's interesting, Rowan, that the leatherback, I think uniquely, is able to generate its own internal body heat. Having been around for all those millennia, I would have thought that something as prescient as the leatherback or the turtle would have learned to do this earlier, and that we should have other turtles and other sea creatures generating their own body heat, because it gives you access to the coldest waters where the oxygen levels are very high and food is very abundant. It seems strange that they never bothered to do this, most turtles, the leatherback being the unique one, I think. Is that true anyway?
Well, yes, with heat, I mean, generating your own heat, you can lose heat in seawater very quickly. So they'd have to have a source of regenerative heat, to be honest with you, or continuous heat to keep them cool and keep them warm, depending on the type of waters that they're in. One of the ways that they do control their heat, particularly on land, maybe not when they're in sea, is that I've seen nesting leatherbacks on the beach, because it's hot, tropical, warm weather that they're going into. So they're leaving 20 degrees water into ambient atmospheric temperature of about 27, 28, sometimes a little bit hotter in the Caribbean nights. So what they do is, while they're not generating heat, they're trying to cool themselves down. So they flush the blood that's to the skin surface while they're on the beach. And this is why you'll see them become this rosy red hue on their skin. Their skin is like elephant skin. And you'll see that in between the skin, there's a lot of red, and they're actually flushing the warm blood to the skin surface to cool themselves down. And it's they actually do get very warm, obviously being quite large as well. But to keep themselves warm, as I said, they do have this countercurrent heat exchange system. But I think one of the things that they have evolved, which is the most important thing in their life cycle, obviously deposition of eggs, is to cool themselves down so they're not too stressed. So in some ways, they have a cooling system rather than a heating system that works in their advantage.
Rowan, talking of temperature and turtles, one of the very unusual things about them, which poses a risk to their survival, is that the sex of their offspring is determined by the temperature at which the egg was incubated on a beach. I know that if it's generally, I don't know exact temperatures to, off the top of my head, but I know if the cooler temperatures favour male offspring and the larger or the higher temperatures mean that the offspring will be female. Are we seeing these sex ratios becoming skewed in the leatherback turtle? And is that a big threat to their future existence, do you think?
It's a very, very important question. I mean, the way I always remember this was hot chicks and cold males, because when the sand is hot, then you produce more females, as you say, and then and when the sand is cooler, it's generally around 50 or 60 degrees Fahrenheit, you get males coming out. Yes, you're right. This is a huge problem. With climate change, eroding beaches, with climate change and even plastics on the surface of the beach, changing the core temperature of the surface of the sand and the availability of nesting sites, again due to climate change, erosion and deposition and sea level rises, it is making a big difference. And of course you have to, what recent studies have shown, that predominantly there's more males in certain species, greens and hawksbills, than there is in leatherbacks, and the idea being that it's highly competitive in order to procreate with a female leatherback now, because there's more males, and this is due to some of the reasons which I've outlined. But essentially that, and you know, when we put big developments on the coast, we're looking at areas that would cool the sand and shade the sand, and the temperature is key. So we're over that tipping point at the moment in certain species of sea turtles, and some of it's in the unknown, but the general consensus in the scientific community is very much that the sands are getting hotter due to temperature rises. I mean, as Derek mentioned, I was in Belize a couple of weeks ago, and they have extreme heat of 42 degrees periodically on the day, so much so that electrical components, which is why I was there for subsea cables, can't cope. So in actual fact, if you have sea turtle beaches, nesting beaches, exposed to daily 40 plus degrees Celsius, you're going to have an impact on any sea turtles that are there, that are in the sand. And of course, that will obviously make more females, but then you could have the gender bias skewed the other direction. So it's worrying times.
The last time we spoke to you, Rowan, you were working with the global engineering management and development consultants, Mott MacDonald. Are you still with them or you've moved on?
I'm now working with a company called Ocean Science Consulting in Dunbar, and I can't wait to really get my teeth into these things. I'm very much going to be working on, would you believe, unexploded ordnances and underwater noise and rig to reef projects. In other words, like, what are the oil reefs off Scotland going to do when they're defunct? Well, let's make them into a reef. Let's make them into a habitat that can aggregate fish and support biodiversity and maybe even support climate change. So yeah, it's over the next while, I'll be working on a number of projects with Ocean Science Consulting to develop a lot of understandings about the impacts of underwater noise and acoustics, and doing a lot of studies like that. And I'll probably be back to you again, Derek, because I'll have a couple of other research projects that we're working on, and share them with you. But it would also do with marine mammals as well. So exciting times ahead, to be honest.
Absolutely. And once again, Rowan, on behalf of the entire nation of Ireland, congratulations. You're the first Irishman, to the best of our knowledge, to have an image chosen by the US Postal Service for their stamps. So well done to you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Derek. And thank you to you all.
And that's pretty much all we have time for tonight. My thanks to Aina Nealana, Richard Collins, Terry Flanagan and Niall Hatch. Earlier, we heard The Carpenters from 1975 with their number one hit, Mr. Postman. But originally, it was a hit for a group called The Marvelettes in 1961. Notable as the first Motown song to reach the number one position on the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. Until next week, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Right.